You are listening to an informal debate on climate justice, South Africa, and the World Bank between Professor Patrick Bond of the University of KwaZulu-Natal and the Center for Civil Society in Durban, South Africa, and Professor William Mumma of Tufts University and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The event took place on April 9, 2010, at the Encuentro Cinco Movement Space in Boston, Massachusetts, in the United States. It was recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike License 2010 by Jason Pramus for Open Media Boston, www.openmediaboston.org. So both our speakers are here. I guess we're going to get going now. Thank you all for coming here to Encuentro Cinco for this lunchtime talk on climate justice, South Africa, and the World Bank, subjects I know about separately myself, but I've never seen put all together, so this will be exciting for me at least, and I assume for everybody else as well. I'm Jason Pramus with Open Media Boston. I'm going to be chairing the discussion, and let me just quickly introduce our speakers. Patrick Bond on the left is a professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and director of the Center for Civil Society, both in Durban, South Africa. And William Mumma is a professor at Tufts University and sits on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and I'm glad to have you both here today. So I guess Patrick's going to go first, and he has a presentation.
Yeah, I'll make the case again. So it's really good of you to come, and we'll look forward to seeing what the rebuttals will be. But the basic terrain here is the electricity intensity in the South African economy is out of control. Dating back a century, you know, when deep mining in this Johannesburg area was required to get the gold out. And so by the late 20s, a state-owned company, Eskom, was built up because the private sector wasn't able on its own to kind of get such power to go deep into the mines to get the gold. And the power has mainly been generated in the coal-rich area called Mpumalanga province. That's on the eastern and in the northern, especially where that top arrow is going, which is Limpopo province. Roughly in that Medupi area, and there are, as you heard on the Democracy Now!, about 40 new mines that are anticipated for digging to supply both Medupi and the subsequent huge big, which will be the third biggest coal-fired plant called Kusile. Medupi is in the second poorest province. It's near Lephalale. The customers for Medupi are largely the huge corporations that are centered in both that sort of Vaal area, the Vaal River, where there's a huge steel complex and a coal-to-oil complex. And on the coast, Richards Bay especially has some of the largest smelters of aluminum in Africa, run by mainly by BHP Billiton, the big company based in Melbourne, the biggest metals mining company in the world. Formerly, actually, a large part of it was called Gencore, which was a South African company, which in a very kind of suspicious transaction in the 1990s where the former finance minister of apartheid was involved, they were allowed to take money abroad to buy Shell's Billiton, and it became BHP Billiton as a result. The World Bank has agreed yesterday to lend Eskom $3.75 billion. It's a travesty. There are 10 major reasons, lots of minor reasons, but I'll take a couple minutes to give you the 10 best reasons they should have rejected the loan. And the U.S. shouldn't have abstained but voted no. It was ridiculous for the U.S. to posture that it's caring about the environment to vote, to fail to vote on this, to abstain. Climate destruction, the local ecologies in the area around Medupi and the mines serving the coal-fired plant. The lack of participation and the failure to abide by standard World Bank procedures, and especially procurement. The fact that poor people will be hit with high prices, disconnections, social strife and oppression will rise, multinational corporations are the main beneficiaries, the profits will flow out of the country, affecting the current account balance, there will be a dramatic increase in foreign debt, privatization is part of the process, ANC corruption, right, the ruling party, corruption-ridden, will get more corrupt and more wealthy by far. And the World Bank has such an apartheid, and indeed a class apartheid, post-apartheid, history of increasing inequality and lack of access as part of its basic functions in South Africa. Those are 10 reasons. Let me go through them. But I do want to say first that the report that I think Bill and his two colleagues did was utterly unprofessional. You don't mind me saying in a frank way, we're all very frank about this. To say that there are strong development imperatives for this project, security, reliability, and access, and then to say the criterion is well met, is to be blind or biased. Here's why. The climate destruction is awesome, about 25 million tons of CO2 a year, more than the amount emitted by 115 countries just with this one power plant, 4,800 megawatts. We are already in South Africa emitting 20 times the amount of CO2 in the energy sector per unit, per person GDP, than even the great climate Satan, the United States, a 20 times worse in the U.S. per person per unit of economic output as a sort of measure of the energy intensity and the coal intensity of that energy. There is a long-term mitigation scenario, which I'm afraid bamboozled my dear colleague Prof. Muma, because it calls for reductions to meet the levels required by science, and yet in reality it doesn't come anywhere close. You've been hearing perhaps that there's a 34% cut promised by 2020. That's a sort of notional cut from what they call growth without constraints. And as EarthLife Africa has pointed out, it's absolutely farcical. It's a scam that the South African government went to the Copenhagen Climate Summit in December to make that argument. But in reality, it's building this fourth and then next the third largest coal-fired plant in the world, plus doing coal to oil through Sasol. Secondly, there are local ecologies and local health considerations to be factored in, which I don't think were in the expert report or by the bank. Medupi has no scrubbers, though they may be put in later. The reason is because it's a relative lack of pollution in the area at present. The actually ambient, the SO2 standards, because of plants in the areas that are quite high, 40 new mines will be open. They are using a dry cooling technology. The area is basically without water. And water degradation is associated with the mining industry. Coal mines have destroyed the water tables and the groundwater. I mean, crocodiles are turning belly up in that area. So water and the rest of the ecological considerations weren't taken into consideration. And the local communities have filed an inspection panel, World Bank inspection panel report on Tuesday to complain about that precisely. In fact, they weren't involved at all in the participation in the World Bank's deliberations. They had one little set of meetings in Pretoria in December. One civil society group went there, but a legal group. But basically, it was without any connection to the local folks affected. Procurement rules were violated openly. They claimed because it was already a coal-fired power plant in progress. But there are huge governance crises in this borrower. The leadership's just been totally turned over. They don't even have a full-time CEO. They've got an acting CEO at the moment. The last CEO is in court asking for about $12 million in compensation, and the court records are showing that he was fired for incompetence, but he was the one that did the deal on the Dupi and signed up the loan with the bank. His name, Jacob Maroka. Price increases are out of control, and they're causing a huge political crisis because it's 25% per year is what the regulators just given permission to. Eskom asked for 35%. In real terms, 127% increase over 5 years. Widespread opposition includes massive protests all over the country. It's the most protest-rich country in the world at the moment per person, largely because of what we call service delivery deficits, or the electricity, the price, the disconnections, the lack of access is central to these. In addition, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, with about 1.4 million members, has threatened a national strike. And they've said even if it interferes with the World Cup, June 11, they'll go ahead because they're so angry at the price increase associated with Eskom and the disconnections associated with the price increases. At a time when South Africa's raced ahead of Brazil to become the most unequal country, large country in the world. And it's because of World Bank policies adopted in 1996, the World Bank's role in the growth, employment, and redistribution policy, which in fact did the opposite, decline unemployment and polarization economics, Duke, not gear. So that policy that the World Bank had its model and two of its staff working on had this effect, thanks to the World Bank and its ideas about Washington consensus. There were disconnections that have been measured variously at over a million a year. Right now, of Eskom's 4 million customers, not even to mention the municipal customers, a third are recording zero consumption because they're disconnected. Now, many are illegally reconnected, but you get a sense of Kumalo here ripping out her prepayment meter and actually having to reconnect. Now, there are electrocutions as a result of this. 60 people per year die as electrocution and the reconnections, unfortunately. And kids are often stepping over wires, live wires in the township. So it's a terrible situation. And it also leaves the communities without circuit breakers, because as ESKOM pulls its meters or disconnects, then as the reconnections occur, the brownouts just swing right through the townships like Soweto. And as you see, lots of protests about ESKOM. This is just from one event, and protests specifically about this loan. But across the country, about 8,000 protests per year is what the police are measuring. But we think it's actually double that at the moment. And as I say, this is largely a function of how desperately unequal and how poverty's increased since 1994 in the cities, according to the government's own stats. White people, by the way, have gotten 24% richer, while blacks have gotten poorer. Another reason is that the corporations, including South African capital, but mainly foreign capital, which used to be South African, like Anglo-American, now based in London, formerly Joburg, De Beers, many of these huge mining operations, are getting the cheapest electricity in the world. When the aluminum price falls, the estimates are that the price of electricity dips to $0.01 per kilowatt hour because of pricing-related special pricing agreements. ESKOM lost $1.3 billion last year because of these agreements. And these agreements were just renegotiated, but they're still secret. Nobody knows how much. The renegotiation was said to be favorable to BHP, Billiton, and Anglo. And ESKOM brags, this is its last annual report, at providing the cheapest electricity in the world. But it's not for the masses, not at all. Those guys are suffering the disconnections. It's for big corporations. Averaged out, it's about 5 cents, U.S. cents a kilowatt hour. Australia second at 6.5. The U.S. Comes in on this list. Actually, it's not on the list. Oh, yes, there it is. Coming in at about 9.5. So nearly half as cheap as the U.S. The profits don't stay in South Africa. They go to BHP Billiton, Anglo, ArcelorMittal, Xstrata, the other big users who are all in Melbourne, London, Luxembourg, Zurich in those cases. And the pressure on the current account, what you're seeing is a crash in the payments that go to dividends and profits abroad. The trade deficit is a little bit of a problem, although it's now a trade surplus. But you can see that it's really the outflow of dividends that's put South Africa in a situation that The Economist magazine calls it the riskiest emerging market in the world. That's the outflow of profits to the big multinationals that's caused that. And that's going to get much worse with Medupi. Also worse is the foreign debt, already $75 billion, and it's now, as of yesterday, up another 5%. We're at the level now of foreign debt that P.W. Botha took South Africa to in 1985. That was the point at which apartheid effectively crashed, because it was over-indebted, and the U.S. banks, thanks to pressure by Nkwentra Five and all of the folks that were doing anti-apartheid work, forced banks to pull out of South Africa due to apartheid. The banks were ready to pull out anyway because we were hitting those danger levels. And that's where we are now. Again, a factor not taken into consideration by the bank or the expert panel. We are really looking at a new kind of slavery where South Africa is going to be taking orders at some point from international finance. And we get the very clear sense that in putting together policies like electricity or basic infrastructure, the World Bank's had already what they even themselves brag about as being an instrumental effect on policy. Plus, the currency keeps crashing. Aside from Zimbabwe, our four neighbors, which lost their currency entirely, there's been no major country with as many currency crashes as South Africa. So when we take a $3.5 billion loan in dollars and the rand crashes, more exports are going to be needed and the repayment is going to be much harder. It'll be much more expensive because we'll be repaying with more expensive dollars, making the effective interest rate that much higher. Another factor not taken into consideration at all. Privatization is being pushed, especially in the renewable component, but also for the next big power plant. And the big trade unions are, of course, opposed. But you can see even in the World Bank's little minimal fact sheet there, they're promoting investment led by the private sector, something very objectionable because the South African state really needs to do what it has always done, taking its huge capacity and centralized power, and actually do something to solve the problem. Right now, ESKOM doesn't want to do renewable electricity because it wants the country to dependent on coal-fired centralized power, not on decentralized solar that can be provided. 5 more minutes, but let me just wrap up with a couple more because this is the most shocking. The ruling party of South Africa, right, the president, Jacob Zuma, facing 84 counts of personal corruption associated with French arms dealers in a ridiculous $5 billion arms deal. Those counts of corruption just controversially whisked aside by the state prosecutor, just dropping them just before last year's election. There are so many cases of corruption, this arms deal has just been the tip of the iceberg. And now the ANC, which was once a liberation movement we all supported, right? I'm sure all of you are shocked to hear this. Nelson Mandela's movement is so corrupt that even the government, in its public protector role, they have a little office, said that the chairman of ESCOM acted improperly. His name is Vali Musa, chair of ESCOM, head of the IUCN, former environment minister, because he was also on the ANC's finance committee. He acted improperly when he arranged a deal in which Hitachi, in which the ANC's finance company, which is called Chancellor House, got a 25% investment in that company, and they got a boiler deal that, when you look at just the pure profits anticipated from the deal that the World Bank is now financing, will give them $135 million in just pure profit flowing into the ruling party's coffers. What do you think that's going to do to democracy in South Africa? It's no chance, right? This is a de facto one-party state. And finally, the World Bank has such a record that I think, and many of my colleagues think, it has only one function left in South Africa, to come back and repay reparations for its empowerment of apartheid. Because from 1951, 3 years after formal apartheid began, the World Bank came, found the fascists there. These were the same guys that supported Nazism, and they came to power in South Africa, Afrikaner nationalists. And the World Bank made $100 million worth of loans. How many black people got electricity from ESCOM's $100 million of loans? Exactly, zero. Because the World Bank financed white corporations and rich white folks, just like they're doing now. You can go back and see all the records of what the World Bank owes black South Africa for financing and empowering apartheid. There are U.S. corporations in the same situation. They're the subjects of an Alien Tort Claims Act lawsuit. That lawsuit went to the Supreme Court last year. The Supremes found that they were in conflict of interest because they owned so many shares of these apartheid profiting corporations. They had to kick it back to the Southern District. So it is going through that Southern District. The great late poet Dennis Brutus was the lead plaintiff, and on his deathbed last December 26th was so pleased that Archbishop Njungunkulu Ndungani came to him and said, "We are pushing these reparations lawsuits through, and once we get the corporations, the World Bank is next." So we have $100 million in loans to ESCOM. When the United Nations asked the World Bank not to lend to apartheid, they said, "No, we're going to keep going because we're not political." The IMF was supporting apartheid after the Soweto Rebellion. As recently as 1983, Ralph Nader was able to push the World Bank out of South Africa. But still, the World Bank came back to sanctions bust via a Lesotho World Bank loans, which I'm sure you'd agree are environmentally disastrous and one of the most corrupt projects ever discovered. Lots of corruption in Swiss bank accounts being prosecuted. The World Bank, late in the day, starts to finally debar some of the companies. But that was a World Bank loan to help fund the Pretoria. And the IMF came in with value-added tax and macroeconomic policies and a whole bunch of other activities like market-oriented land reform, smaller housing policies, no electricity connections in its infrastructure advice for a 44% cut in the monthly grant to impoverished dependent children, participation in the failed homegrown structural adjustment program, GEAR, always saying wages are too high, need more labor flexibility, more privatized infrastructure investments. The World Bank's IFC, amongst its 15 or 13 loans, financed Domino's Pizza as a poverty...
You have 1 minute?
Yeah, 1 minute. And then structural adjustment in the region, and a stubborn refusal by the bank and the IMF to cancel debt. We can go through maybe a little later about what's to be done. But very simply, after this exercise, if you think the World Bank should be the major climate funder, right, which is what Robert Zoellick was trying to do, when he went to Copenhagen and working with the G20, the G8 and the G20. He'll try it again in Toronto and in Cancun. Right? And if you think that the World Bank, with its new energy policy, is doing the right thing by moving to renewable, and if you think that the World Bank's fighting poverty, and if you think that institutions that have any social consciousness should buy World Bank bonds, I ask you to think again, because the money that on April 15 you'll be paying to the U.S. government is coming back to South Africa And if we've got any justice, we will eventually default on the money that you are going to be giving as U.S. citizens to the World Bank to lend for this dirty project. One of the city supervisors of San Francisco said yesterday, this coal-stained World Bank should not get any San Francisco bonds. And 10 years ago, thanks to Dennis Brutus, the World Bank bonds boycott began, and I'll give you a little more information later about how you can support it. To make sure that the World Bank goes bankrupt because of this kind of lending. 10 years ago, it was because the World Bank was a financier of global apartheid, as we called it. Before that, the World Bank was a financier of apartheid. There are lots of reasons why we should be defunding and decommissioning the World Bank. And I don't think any expert panel can deny that this is one of them. Thanks.
Thanks, Professor Bond. So now, Professor Mumma, please do your thing.
All right. You just heard a very impassioned plea here. And obviously, I cannot compete with Professor Bond in terms of his knowledge about the details of South Africa. I've been there several times. I've done some work there. I have never consulted for the World Bank ever before. I've always been a great critic of the World Bank. But when the World Bank came and said, we're trying to put together an expert panel, and on that panel will be Dr. Ogunlade Davidson, who is the energy minister of Sierra Leone. He has was for 12 years the co-chair of the mitigation section of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I'd worked with him on that for many years. And the third person was someone at the International Energy Agency who had also worked on climate issues. And I have worked most of my life and professional life in the last certainly 20, almost 25 years now on climate change and energy issues. I said, well, it doesn't look to me. Oh, and by the way, this is the first time the World Bank has ever called an expert panel on any power plant project. They've done it for dams, but never for any power plant project. And finally, for the very first time, the World Bank agreed that our report would go online before a decision was made, before the board met. And they kept that agreement. That is more transparent than the World Bank has ever been. Now, my preference would be pretty much what yours is, that we not add another coal-burning power plant to the world anywhere. The reality is this power plant system, complex, really a complex, it's six units, each one enormous, 800 megawatts, in a desert region. The total project is about $14 or $15 billion. $1 billion alone will go to bringing in water. Our report points out that may not work. There may not be enough water. South Africa is going to run out of water to cool power plants, even using so-called dry cooling, long before they're going to run out of coal. South Africa has the fourth largest coal reserves in the world, and I mean that's sort of stunning. I mean, you know, with the the U.S. And China being right up at the top. So it's the resource that they naturally think of going to. This project was already underway. The only reason that South Africa didn't want to go ahead and do it on its own is obviously the financial crisis made it difficult for them to complete the project, as far as I can tell. So the three of us looked at this project and we said, our preference would be that they not build the project, that the climate implications are significant. However, the total carbon dioxide contribution from all of Africa is 3% of the total. The total amount of electricity in sub-Saharan Africa for, 800 million people is about the same as the total electric power of Argentina, which has, 60 or 70 million people?
1/10.
40 million, a lot less, 1/20. Right? Obviously, if there's to be development in South Africa, electricity is usually important. Now, Professor Bond has pointed out, obviously, the electricity needs to get to the people. And just as South Africa has actually done quite a bit to get water to the people, I mean, the transformation from the end of apartheid till now in terms of access to clean water is very impressive by any standard. I have people working on water issues, and this is a place where South Africa has done really well. But what you heard is, in South Africa, there are at least three or four different devils. And the question is, which devil are you going to? Why would you want the government, which is so corrupt, to be the one that decides everything? How much more corrupt or differently corrupt is the ANC and the South African government than either the World Bank's policies or the private sector or any other group in South Africa? I mean, it's a huge problem. Corruption is what is bringing down development all over the world. And the question is, what is the best strategy for getting there? Our judgment, he said we were unprofessional. I don't believe we were unprofessional at all. This is not a group of rubes. These are people who have a lot of international experience and a lot of experience in Africa. Was that since this project was going to be built anyway, could we leverage the World Bank in a very public way to change their direction and policies? Could we convince them that this is basically by going ahead with this project, which, by the way, in our report, we suggest might not work. You know, one of the reasons they can't put scrubbers on this plant is there's not enough water. There's going to be barely enough water to cool the power plants with so-called dry evaporative cooling. So they are really out on a limb here. And whether or not they'll actually be able to manage to build and operate these eight units, I'm not convinced they'll be able to do that, given the constraints of nature. So basically, if you go on the World Bank website and read our recommendations, they are that South Africa, it's couched this way, if they decide to finance this project, that they basically define it as a transition strategy, that since, and by the way, it was also to try to leverage the South African government, NESCOM, which has made statements about they want to see their emissions peak in 2020 to 2025 and then start down. That cannot happen if you build Medupi and then the other three projects after this. That instead of building any projects, coal projects after this, we gave them a portfolio of, I'd have to go back and count, there must be at least 20 different things that could be done that would dramatically transform the South African economy, but for which South Africa is going to not have the finance or resources to do so. So in this, we recommend that the World Bank help to transform the South African economy to dramatically lower this outrageously high energy per GDP, energy per capita number that they have. That a project, I mean, you know, here's stuff, if you've ever been to South Africa, you know, it's the land of sunshine, and yet the number of solar hot water heaters even, the number of solar panels that you see is just, I mean, I don't think I ever saw one, to tell you the truth. There might have been one somewhere, but, you know.
2,000.
Yeah, or 2,000 in the whole country. All right, that's a figure I wish we'd had. But we knew there weren't many, and we said so. And so we said, okay, here are things you can do. And you start adding these things up, and they basically obviate the need for any more large coal-burning power plants. Now, the World Bank had put in we were polite enough not to say this in the report, but among ourselves we talked about a fig leaf. The fig leaf was, okay, you've got this 4.8, or let's call it 4,800 megawatts of coal plant at Medupi, and then there was to be 100 megawatts of wind power and 100 megawatts of solar concentrated power. So let me get this right, 200 versus 4,800. Okay. Well, we just said, okay, you've already, if you like, lost your innocence on this, World Bank, by saying you think you ought to put these in. Let's scale it up. Let's scale it up a lot. And let's not just scale it up in South Africa, but let's think about it in terms of the region, Southern Africa. Because one of the things that is also true, yes, a lot of this power goes to these incredibly energy-intense mining industries, but some of South Africa's power goes to the countries that surround it. I mean, South Africa is the...
That's about even, because there's also imports.
Well, there's imports from, you know, from the hydro projects and, nearby and so forth. But there's a lot of South African power that goes out of the country. Without South Africa, and South Africa is really the only country in the region that has the potential capacity to develop power on a scale to begin to meet the electricity needs in Southern Africa. I mean, whatever your ideology is, you know the famous statement by Lenin that that communism was socialism with electricity. Right? Well, one could also, you know, I'm sure Adam Smith, if he'd known about it, would have said capitalism is the, you know, is basically, or excuse me, capitalism is something with electricity. It's free markets with electricity, or something like that. And it's true, no matter what your ideology is, what your system is, electricity, at least since about 1900, has been critical to the economic development of just about every country in the world that has developed economically. There's huge potential, and we document this in the report, or we point this out, for the use of renewable energy in South Africa, and that the World Bank should take this on. And what was interesting is that... The response from ESCOM was actually far more favorable to doing that than was the response, initial response of either the South African government or the World Bank. So I don't want to paint ESCOM as any great saint here. By the way, we also called on the government, since Sasol, the coal to liquid fuels plant, which is an ecological disaster of the first magnitude, should also be brought under this system of transforming the economy of South Africa. So, all right, Patrick's willing to make a deal with the devil of the ANC. We were willing to make a deal with the devil of the World Bank. Our deal was for the World Bank to agree to change its ways. I don't know whether three people on an expert panel can accomplish that. But it was our decision to go ahead and make that particular case. And if we're successful, this could be important to far beyond South Africa. It could transform the way the bank does business. I have not seen the details of the decision that was made yesterday. I'm very eager to see them. I got an email saying that the bank board had voted to go ahead with the funding project. I don't know what it said about the other parts of our recommendation. I'm eager to see that. If the bank does not live up to that, the fact that this has been such a transparent process means that others, including a former student of mine who's very much involved in the strong opposition to this project, and who kept me informed of all the bad reasons for doing, you know, all the reasons not to do the Medupi project. Our hope is that they would use this expert panel report and say, not good enough. But I don't think it's possible to stop this project. That was our conclusion. It was going to happen. And so in happening, could we leverage things? And as I said, in a sense, we made a deal with one devil. Patrick is talking about making a deal with a different devil. The goal should be, and all of us, I think, would agree on this, not only to reduce the contributions to climate change, but also to increase equity and to bring the benefits of electricity to all the people of South Africa, all of Southern Africa, all of Africa, all of the poor parts of the world. And one of the problems, if you've noticed, we did not get very far in Copenhagen with international agreement. And it was blocked by north, south, east, and west. And I think one of the reasons it's blocked is because what we're negotiating is a pollution control treaty, a kind of 1970s version. Stop polluting. You've got a tailpipe and you're emitting from it, stop doing it. And you have to stop by 20%, and you have to stop by 40%, and you have to stop by 10%. And we can't quite figure out how to deal with poor countries So we'll say that we will give them access to technology and capacity and so forth, but nobody does it. And I think telling people what they can't do, after all, doesn't always work very well. And instead, if we were to turn this agreement around into a treaty that is really about development, and it basically says the goal of this treaty is to provide energy services to everyone in the world in a manner that does not disrupt the climate system, then we'd be talking a very different game. The protocols we'd be talking about would be about how do you deliver electricity to everybody? Why electricity? Well, because electricity delivers so many of these energy services. And can you do it in a way that does not disrupt the climate system? Can we do it in a way that is, under the rubric of sustainable development, meets the goals of society, that we can have a sustainable society, we can have a sustainable economy, and we can have a sustainable environment, including the climate system. So let me stop there, because I can't stay for very long. Unfortunately, it's very fortunate, I have a doctoral student who is about to defend at 2:00, and I have to be back to hear him do that. And it's all about climate. So,
well, thanks for speaking, Professor. So I was going to have you to, this isn't a formal debate, kind of, you know, respond to each other or whatever.
Sure.
However, if you have to leave, maybe we should just open it up.
Okay, sure. Why don't we do that? Yeah, I'd like to hear from people here.
So, questions?
Names too.
Yeah. So please give your name when you speak.
You. Richard Kreshnik. If you concluded that the power plant was going to happen anyway, with or without the World Bank money, then it seems to me it would have made more sense to recommend against the World Bank law and recommend that if the World Bank was going to invest in energy expansion and accessibility in South Africa, it should do it in the ways that you suggested that the energy system transition to. I don't see, in your explanation, I don't understand any justification for your recommendation that the World Bank loan go ahead. It seems to me we should have recommended that it not go ahead because the project is a bad project and shouldn't happen, as you all three apparently agreed. And that if the project happens, it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't have the blessing of the World Bank. Shouldn't have the support. And the World Bank money, if they want to make a $3.75 billion loan, they should make the loan expanding wind and solar and blah, 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 and decentralizing and increasing accessibility to the populace, the way we know that a more renewable system will generate, you know, more distributed access.
Well, it's a perfectly legitimate point. It's something we discussed. We also agreed that it was probably about a 90% certainty the bank was going to approve the loan anyway. And so we were thinking, all right, $3.75 billion sounds like a lot of money, but what about $100 billion over the next several years going to wind and solar and renewables? If we could shift the direction of the bank to do that and not fund another one of these, we thought that would have a bigger bang. Now, you know, you can say you guys are naive, you really missed the boat, and maybe that's right. History will tell. On the other hand, if it happens the way we would like to see it happen, then basically, you know, we've sinned a little and hopefully have gained a lot.
Okay.
So that's...
Sorry,
you made a pretty amazing comparison. You said that you're supporting one devil, the World Bank, and Patrick's supporting another devil, the
corrupt government of South Africa.
Yeah, but the government is democratically accountable. It does have to put itself up for elections, whereas the World Bank is not at all democratically accountable. And to make the contrast that the ANC is corrupt, but what about the World Bank's interests? I mean, what motivates the bank's interests? It's not like the bank is just filled with people who need money. Who are altruistic. They have interests. It's an institution in a global economy that has specific interests. I mean, how much poverty has the World Bank reduced in the last 30 years?
I don't think it's reduced nearly enough. And the last two...
It's worse than nearly enough. They don't even have stats to explain, to prove that they reduced.
Okay, but the last two presidents of the World Bank have agreed that that's the case, that the World Bank has failed to eradicate poverty. I shouldn't say the last two, the last one and the previous one before the one who was such a disaster. I mean, let's put it this way, more of a disaster than some of the other previous ones, okay?
So how do you equate a democratically accountable government with the World Bank?
I'm not equating them at all. I'm just saying each is a devil. Each has its problems. And, you know, I've always taken the position that, you know, the advantage of a democratically elected government, say, over a private corporation is I get to vote for the one, and unless I own stock, I cannot vote for the other. But the point is that each of these are power centers, and each of them can be influenced in different ways. The vote is not the only way to influence. I mean, if you want to influence corporate behavior, we've seen the power of consumer boycotts. Right? In other words, we voted with our feet and our dollars instead of with our, since we can't vote for the on the board, we voted that way. The World Bank is also influenced obviously by the amount of funds it has, and increasingly the World Bank is more and more aware of its of the currency of its reputation, which is not good. And so it seemed to us, I mean, I would not have recommended this 10 years ago because I think the World Bank was too obtuse at that time. They may still be too obtuse, but they are less obtuse than they were before. And so, again, we made a calculated risk here, and we said, okay, if we could leverage $3.75 billion in one coal plant into tens or perhaps $100 billion of renewable energy projects in developing countries, that's the calculation we made. And as I said, I cannot promise you that this is going to happen. But it was certainly, that is kind of our goal.
Marilyn?
I just wanted to add a few things to what you said, Thomas. You said that history will tell.
It will.
But I would say history has already told a lot about the World Bank, and I would phrase your question a little differently. Not how much poverty have they alleviated, but
how much have they created?
Poverty have they caused?
Yeah.
And the question I have is about, you had said before that you expect the report, if they don't go through with the report, will be used by people to say, look, you didn't go through with it. But then you said they were going to approve it anyway, the loan. So it seems, adding to what Richard said, it could have been a really great opportunity for the report to be used even better if you had done something like what Richard said, because they would have gone through with it anyway, and you would have said, look, these are the reasons why you shouldn't.
And if we've done that, then I can guarantee you they would have totally ignored our recommendations. Let's come back a year from now and let's find out. I'm game for this, and I will take your slings and arrows at that time, if I'm wrong.
Will you repay your consultancy fees for the people suffering in South Africa?
I make significant donations, not maybe directly to them, but to others in the field.
Okay, we have other hands, and please say your full name if you can.
I'm Arthur McEwen. Patrick, the whole building of this operation seems to me to be perfectly consistent with the whole program that the ANC's followed. You focused on the protests, reasonably enough, about this power plant. But I wonder if you could talk, you said you wanted to talk about a little more about the resistance, and I wonder if you could do so in the context of the broader resistance to the whole way in which development is going, because this is part of it.
May I do that after we have the full benefit of Bill's
input? I'm going to have to leave in about 4 minutes.
So okay. Definitely, but shall we just get some others, especially sure. If you can take advantage of Bill?
Yeah, why don't you each, and then I'll try to respond to all, wrap them all up in a minute or two.
Sure.
At the end.
We had four hands that I saw, one there, and what are you pointing to, Sven? Okay, right here, and Eli.
Three and four. Yeah.
So three.
So if you can keep them short, then I'll do my best to respond.
Maybe Patrick, maybe you laid out this, the kind of like, I heard that piece of it. I'm wondering if, with all the problems with service delivery in South Africa, the sort of like mass cutoffs that happened in the late 90s, early 2000s, the fact that thousands and thousands of folks are living using paraffin, impacts on school success, impacts on so many of people's health, environmental health, on so many other things. And that ESCOM, even the collection of arrears that goes back to the rent boycotts in the 80s that's causing cutoffs now by ESCOM, like absolute insanity around service delivery, around electricity. Did you guys consider, not that I think the World Bank would ever do this, since in other countries they're responsible for people losing their electricity or limited access, but did you make recommendations or consider making recommendations around requirements on service delivery to particular, to communities that are not receiving electricity?
We didn't make it in that explicit way, but we did make it more generally. The purpose of extra electricity should be to support the development of South Africa, not just the industrial part.
But since it doesn't, and you say the criterion is well met, would you not have reworded that?
Well, in terms of the information we were given, it does talk about delivering these services to other people, and that's what we were referring to when we said it was
with
well
the
met.
Price increases that they've announced. We've
discussed that to some extent and agree that, basically South Africa has to do what a number of countries have done, which is to decouple energy use and poverty. In other words, have either lifeline rates or subsidies or whatever you need in order for low-income people to have access to electricity. And there has to be a redistribution of the ability to pay in order for that to happen.
Okay, our next two questions here and here.
Daniel Faber, Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative. I'm really interested in how major institutions such as the World Bank are dealing with sort of the latest developments in the area of climate science, because some of the latest scientific developments with respect to the IPCC, which is sort of a consensus document that was based on some older science. There are new scientific discoveries, and James Hansen and others argue that, well, we need to see a fairly rapid decarbonization of the economy, that 450 parts per million is really unrealistic. We're going to be passing tipping points, if not already. Except the Holocene enter a new climactic period unless we see these major reductions, and particularly with the new science around feedback mechanisms. And so to see continued projects that still are going to put more carbon into the atmosphere when we need to see an 80% reduction, in fact, find ways to pull carbon out of the atmosphere is sort of disturbing. I think what we're seeing is a major gulf between what the scientific community is saying and what the political establishment is saying. It's just a massive gulf between the scientific and the political realities. And I think one of the larger questions is the ability of the World Bank to be part of that solution versus part of the problem. So this project is sort of emblematic of that.
It is. And let me just say, just released the World Development Report for 2010 from the World Bank. It's called Climate Change and Development. The entire volume is devoted to that. We just had the co-chair of that speaking at Tufts yesterday, Dr. Rosina Bierbaum, who's the dean at Graduate School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at the University of Michigan, and it makes it very clear that the development has to not be destructive of the climate system. And there are, again, it's all too slow for me. Believe me, I've been at this for over 20 years, and it is really painful to see the slow pace. We used to talk about progress being glacial. Which means really slow. Now what it means is going in reverse rapidly, right? That's what glacial means. We are not going that direction. We're going in a direction where change is beginning to take place, and it could occur very rapidly. Just as we talk about tipping points in climate, I think there'll be tipping points in the decision making and policy making. And the irony is today, if you look at where some of the largest impacts on reducing emissions is, it's in the private sector. It's not governments. governments are behind the curve. Even the progressive ones are behind the curve. And I mean, it's just easier to make decisions if you are in a corporation. So if they get religion on this, they can do it. Look at the Chinese. Dramatic changes in China. I mean, I'm working with the Chinese government right now, and the things they're asking us to research for them are astounding. Astounding. I just wish my own government were as progressive as the Chinese are in wanting to do something, and they know they are a big cause of the problem. They can't say that in the international negotiations, but by God, they are really doing things. It's amazing.
Eli, quick.
My name is Eli Beckerman, and I find a lot of this conversation really disempowering, and to contrast that with what seems like an international, global sort of people's movement that I think Bill McKibben and 350.org have really done. I mean, taking the science that Hansen is saying and really saying that we need to be keeping the carbon in the ground.
Yep.
The whole, like, I think it looked too much to the sort of UN process and this talk about the, you know, corruption in the ANC or the corruption of the World Bank. I mean, to me, it seems like this picture of the corrupt governments of the world, United States government included, it's all the corruption. And I see the contrast, like what they're doing in Bolivia on Earth Day, trying to have some sort of people's summit where we're shifting out of the institutions like the World Bank, because I just don't see them getting us to where we are.
Look, I came to this conclusion 10 years ago after realizing that no matter who was the president, we weren't going to ever ratify the Kyoto Protocol. So I and a group of people started an organization called Clean Air, Cool Planet, which is based here, right up here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And we just said, we're not going to spend our time banging our heads against a wall in Washington. We're going to actually get communities in the Northeast. We're going to get companies in the Northeast. We're going to get universities in the Northeast beginning to do something about climate change. So we got our president of our university to say the U.S. or the Tufts will meet or beat the Kyoto target whether the U.S. ever ratifies this or not. Timberland. You look at what Timberland is doing. It's phenomenal. And we got them started. And I think we need to do this at every level. People summits, you know, every level. Get enough people who care about this in every company, in every city, government. Cambridge, the Cambridge Project on reducing emissions. And I love it. Because the city of Cambridge is doing it. And, of course, being the People's Republic of Cambridge, you've got then the People's Summit out there, right, pushing the city and saying, you're not doing enough. And that's the way it ought to be. That's exactly the way it ought to be. So, anyway, I agree with you. I just think we need this. But I'll tell you, without global institutions, without national governments doing something, it's going to be harder. I mean, if we really had some decent laws and policies in this country, we could be phasing down so dramatically, it would make your head swim. And let me just close with one thing optimistic about all this. You know, people say, my God, we could never do 80% in 40 or 50 years. 80% reduction. If you go back to 1905, only 3% of American households had electricity. Right? Most people used gas lights and kerosene and whale oil. Actually, electricity saved the whales. There would not be any whales if we hadn't done that. Henry Ford was making 14 cars a day in 1905. You go 50 years to 1955, and we had created the automobile suburbs, which I'm not bragging about, but what a transformation. Who was driving horses and wagons other than some nice Amish people? Right? Dramatic technological revolution. I don't think a single maker of wagons and harnesses and so forth ever dreamed that he was about to be out of business in a decade or two. Why do we think that because now about 3% of our electricity is made by non-hydro renewables, that 50 years from now or 40 years from now, we can't have a similar transformation? I mean, I think it's eminently doable. It's only 4% a year, 4% compounded. So in 17 and a half years, we'll be at half our emissions. 17 and a half years after that, or 35 years from now, we'll be down to 25% of our emissions. We're almost 80% in less than that period. And in the 20th century, we did it through a depression, a Great Depression, and two world wars. I know, I hope we don't have to go through all that.
Do you think those numbers don't get us close to where we have to go?
Oh, they do. They do get us close to where we have to go. And then, you know, you spend the rest of the century getting it down that last bit. And I think we can do it.
Aren't those numbers based on...
Yeah, I got to go.
All right, thanks a lot, Professor.
Good. It's actually about... That'll get us to 400 points. Okay, thank you all for having me.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
We have a slogan, talk left,
yeah.
Walk right.
Okay.
I hope you can walk left next time you have a chance.
Believe me, I've walked left a lot in my life, and I don't think we're as far apart as it may have sounded, but I understand your passion and where you're coming from, and believe me, I'm not unsympathetic to it. So keep up the great work,
okay,
all
thanks.
Of you.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, floor is yours, man.
Well, if I can talk for a minute about Art's question of how to take it for a bit, you know, technology, power, my human rights or electricity is violated by this machine. Maybe in a minute it'll warm up, but would there be a few other points that I can pick up from Art on where movement building goes, also in relation to things like 350 and Avaaz and their good work and other solidaristic strategies, and especially Cambridge, since Bill brought up the People's Republic of Cambridge. What can your municipalities, what can your pension funds, your municipal funds, your church endowments, your university endowments, what can they do? So maybe we'll pick that up in a second, but should we pick a few others? Or?
Yeah, if people have questions, points. Sure.
You know, Patrick, in South Africa, there was discussing water. I don't know if water has been that big a success.
Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear that. You know, there was really some notion by the ANC of treating water as a right of citizenship, and then granting citizens a certain allotment of water, and then beginning to charge prices above that. And I know some of those efforts to meter water have been resisted as well. But I'm wondering if there's a model there that could also be applied with respect to electricity.
Great question. I'm so glad you asked that one. Okay, others? This is about to rejoin us.
Everyone's quiet now? Nothing else to say?
Sorry, dear friends.
I asked Saran to come help with the it's his projector.
I think it just is one of those cases where you've got to fiddle with it and hope that it resends. It actually just needs to light up. The movement that has emerged, Art, is formidable. One of my slides will give you a sense of 200 groups around the world that range from our about 65 organizations in South Africa that within about a week of launching the campaign in February had already signed up. And those include very diverse groups that range from the South African Council of Churches to some of the independent trade unions, even the National Union of Metal Workers, which represents the smelters, the auto industry, have said they oppose this loan. And the community groups we saw this morning on Democracy Now!, Desmond Assad, South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. So that should be there. Okay. Plus, we have two extraordinarily good environmental NGOs, technical groups, but that are movement-oriented. They're very much about the red and the green together. Their names are Groundwork, led by Bobby Peake, a Goldman Prize winner, and Earthlife Africa. Earthlife Africa sent Makoma Kalakala to Washington 2 weeks ago to do some of that lobbying. And, let's try the next one there. Let's try it. And so they've met the sort of Treasury and the Hill folks, and they've met... Okay, here we go. Please. Well, without, as they say, power corrupts. Power corrupts, absolutely. PowerPoint's corrupt, absolutely. That's my problem always. I just wanted to show you how broad that has gone, also internationally, because we actually have, from the rest of Africa, a huge number of people. It sort of a little grated on me that Bill Mumma said we've got to fund this because Africa doesn't have enough power. Actually, South Africa has way too much power and is in a climate debt situation to the rest of the continent, having overused the environmental space, the sink space of Africa, in the way that the U.S. has to the rest of the world. So I think some of you probably heard of the phrase climate debt. Another way to think about it is polluter pays. The Obama administration went to Copenhagen to deny that, and I'm sorry that Bill Mumma just hasn't got it, you know, that South Africa is also a climate debtor and should be paying Africa. And so the fact that South Africa is going to use all this electricity to continue giving the cheapest electricity in the world to multinationals, to outflow of profits, for privatization of the electricity, for the corruption of the ANC, made about 200 groups really angry. And again, with 350.org and Avaaz, part of that, tens of thousands of signatures and petition signatures as part of this. So this campaign is just getting going, because when I sort of thought, well, at some point a good government will actually look at this loan in default, the way a good government like in Ecuador looked at the corrupt and maldevelopmental loans that they inherited in January 2009, Rafael Curry said, no, we're going to default. So part of the project, especially of Jubilee South Africa, has been to say, who really owes what to who in all of this? And Bill Mumma's role in actually justifying this loan means I think we'll be coming back to him and saying, well, you know, put your consultancy funds into some reparations, because the report where he said it was the developmental impact of this project was well achieved is absolutely absurd. What the progressive forces that have, you know, 67 groups have come together to say what we want is more free basic electricity for the masses. And the way you do this is quite easy. It comes back to Danny's question of the nature of basic services. It's what we call a block tariff. You get a free basic amount, not just electricity, water, and then if you use more than that free basic amount, you pay more, and it's called a rising block tariff. If you do that, and hopefully you start not with 50 kilowatt hours per household per month, a tokenistic tiny amount. I mean, just to boil a kettle will take 3 kilowatt hours, so you're kind of using that full monthly amount. And if you're a granny with, you know, sort of 3 or 4 shack dwellers in the backyard and another 8 children, which is not uncommon, large households now with the AIDS pandemic, then you're really out of this 50 kilowatt hours very quickly, then you're on the prepayment meter. At that point, you don't get your gender equity, your respiratory disease prevention, or other public health benefits of electricity. You don't get your educational benefits of transferring from candlelight to an electric bulb. Local enterprises, services desegregation, the other kind of public goods and merit goods don't kick in. And what we found as well, if those of you who know about neoliberalism and its technologies, the favorite technology for service delivery is a prepayment meter. You pay first. You get a little plastic disc or a card. Once you've paid at a kiosk, and then you go and put it into your meter, and then you get the service. Unlike in white areas, traditionally white areas like where I live, where we are on a credit meter system. But when you go to prepayment, which they've been doing over the last decade, you can't then do the rising block tariff. The rising block tariff is important because A, the free basic would give you the universal entitlement, so everybody would get it. Even I, a middle-class academic, would get the free basic, and I should, because we shouldn't be having means tests and indigence policy. We should be penalizing people per person, not household, on the basis of volumetric. In other words, if you use more, then you're going to be paying more. That way you cross-subsidize, and you get conservation. Any of you have ever looked at a microeconomics of service delivery of water or electricity will know that you do get a lower cost per unit for the big users, and that's what BHP Billiton and Anglo argue. And they'll argue that as they come down the cost curve, they should also not pay a higher price, because you've got to get the prices right. If you want a well-functioning provision of water and electricity, don't distort the markets. That's the ideology behind the commodification or commercialization. To privatize means you add another profit markup incentive, cost plus pricing, typically 30% you just put on top. So that's the dotted line B. But Mrs. Kumalo, you saw in that picture, is kind of where A is. She's low consumption and high cost, and hence a high price. And BHP Billiton's down on the bottom right hand, where they're massive consumption, but per unit the prices drop because they just have one big line going in. And that's the theory, in a way, Dan, of trying to get a commercialized, commodified price from the World Bank actually ordering that. Don't distort prices. In contrast to C, which is free electricity for everyone, free water for everyone, and then when you charge above the cost of it, you can have a surplus. You cross-subsidize. You move your surplus to pay the subsidy. And so you're ratcheting up the price so that you get conservation, so we don't have to build more Medupi's, or in the case of water, Lesotho Highland Water Project, this terribly destructive dam project. And so that's the basic conflict between commodification A, privatization B, which just comes after that, and no doubt it'll get much worse. And then C is the eco-social justice decommodification strategy of free plus a luxury tax. That makes sense to everybody? That's our kind of operative conceptual desire, right? When we say we want free basic water and higher, more convex pricing. What did the banks say when this was proposed in the 1994 Reconstruction Development Program? Don't do it. If you do C, you're going to limit the options because your tertiary, your municipal providers, it'll be harder to establish private concessions. In other words, it's going to be harder to privatize if you've actually made a commitment to give people free stuff, right? That makes sense. Private supplier doesn't want to provide free. And so instead of actually doing the free basic services and keeping everybody in, what do you do if people can't pay? The World Bank had a guy called John Room giving advice to the water minister, Qadir Osmal. He said, oh, you need a credible threat of cutting services. So there's a World Bank in a 1995 presentation. I happened to be a special advisor briefly to Qadir Osmal as well, and I just totally lost, and all of the activists lost in those debates about moving to C instead of A. So you could see the World Bank's explicit logic because they didn't incorporate public health, gender equity, environmental protection, economic multipliers, or desegregation. For them, private concessions are important, but for a private supplier, Suez, for example, big French company took over Joburg 2001 to 2006. What the hell do their shareholders care about gender equity or public health mitigation? You know, these are like not a factor for a private company. It's for the state, yes, for the society, yes, but not for the private supplier. So the World Bank doesn't even do these kinds of calculations. And yet they had the gall to tell the truth in their country assistance strategy, quote, our market-related pricing advice, right, the advice I just showed you, was instrumental in facilitating a radical revision in South Africa's approach to water. As a result, in 1999, the cuts were hitting hard, and in a place called Ngwelizani, by August 2000, they'd hit so hard that we had the worst cholera epidemic ever recorded on the continent of Africa. Dozens killed, several hundred thousand were affected. So to get to the second piece, so the first piece is free basic electricity, but not this tokenistic. You know, can you do neoliberalism, price everything, but a little token, you know, 50 kilowatt hours, or for water, it's typically been 6 kiloliters. And there's just been a big lawsuit around the rights issue, and we have lots of papers about why we lost and why there's a limit to rights discourses under liberal capitalist democratic forms, and you have to then move to a commons narrative and common strategies and tactics, which include, as you saw earlier, the commoning of electricity through reconnection, since we don't have good policy. I totally disagree with Bill about doing a deal with the ANC. Everything you're seeing is justifying more resistance and more protest and a massive change in policy, because even though they've given a tiny amount, they're just nowhere near the 100 kilowatt hours per person per month that the Energy Caucus NGOs have said that should be our basic. They're also, as you can see, moving for much more coal and nuke are doing really virtually nothing in solar, wind, and wave, and zero on new systems of extraction, production, transport, consumption, disposal, and a general approach to the economy. They're just continuing business as usual. There is some talk that, oh, well, we can't afford new smelters anymore. So, but that's true, they can't, and they're not going to be able to offer the cheapest electricity to the next batch. But the ones that are there, they still get it. They're on apartheid-era, multi-decade deals. The other three demands very quickly are for a just transition and green jobs so that these metal workers who were doing the aluminum smelting or the autos can move to the passive solar hot water heaters and get 2 million units in, not 2,000, as soon as we can. So that would be sort of part of that strategy. And we definitely need more feedback from experts in this side and activists especially. And then an end to the neoliberal advice from the World Bank. The World Bank has the gall to call its work in South Africa the sort of model knowledge bank work. And it's because they did all that sort of advice and it was accepted. But it's been a disaster. And then to get, as I said, the reparations for the apartheid lending, for the failed structural adjustment. We do have this strategy, and I'd love to just check it out. The basic argument, the World Bank shouldn't exist, right? And we should decommission it. because we don't need loans, we need grants. The loans are too expensive, they're in hard currency. Most of the developmental needs are going to be locally financed with very few imports. You know, building a local school in Tanzania, do you need a dollar for that? Do you need a dollar to pay your Tanzanian teacher? No, you need a kwacha, or a shilling, right? Or you need to buy local bricks or some glass, you know, windows or some local textbooks. So a whole lot of sort of basic needs development that isn't being met doesn't need dollars. And the World Bank is still pushing dollar loans, which become really expensive to pay. And then you shift your country to export orientation. It's inappropriate for lending for basic needs goods. And it forces export orientation. The dollars go into the Reserve Bank and are used for the Wabenzis, right? The luxury elites' imports. And so we really need local currency, debt financing where appropriate, and grants. So as a result, the demand has been from Jubilee South to close the World Bank. And that's from about a decade ago, but it's still a current demand. And now, because of the loan, we've really seen a tremendous interest. I'll just show you the sort of route forward for us about defunding the bank. We used to ask that question during apartheid. Is it morally right to take the benefits of oppression? Is it morally acceptable? In 2000, the activists asked to accept profits from the World Bank during a sort of rising consciousness about global apartheid. And the movement of the landless of Brazil and Jubilee South Africa started the World Bank bonds boycott. And we'd add to that today climate and privatization and corruption. That boycott, in other words, not buy bonds that the World Bank issues, got quite a long way when it was launched exactly a decade ago next week, just before the April 16, 2000 protests. It scared the bank because 80% of its funding comes from issuing the bonds. And then when you can actually take enough of the major investors away, you are talking not just about a moral, but a fiduciary responsibility in calculating whether a major institution should buy World Bank bonds. That's a real threat, one that was joined by scores of municipalities and pension funds, universities, churches, social responsibility funds, and individuals. And then just yesterday, after hearing the news, one of the key politicians in San Francisco, Supervisor Mas Mikarimi, I'm not going to pronounce his name but properly, the loan that was just passed hours before provides sobering proof that the World Bank's recent talk about its commitment to climate finance was nothing but a bunch of hot air. We will renew our commitment to keep our clean money from being tarnished by investment in the World Bank's coal dirty bonds. So that's the second biggest money center in the United States, right? The World Bank, the commitment to have a World Bank bonds boycott by San Francisco. There are three other routes: the $180 billion anticipated recapitalization request that the bank is putting forward. So y'all, as taxpayers, have got to say no. That is not an appropriate use of U.S. tax money in this point, at the time of tremendous austerity you're facing. That the energy-related lending portfolio, they're trying to beef that up and raise specific funds from that from donors. And also the climate finance, especially carbon trading. That's the privatization of the air and is a widespread disaster. It's so good, you saw the New York Times 2 weeks ago, that it's such a failure and so rife with corruption that it's more or less being lost in the Senate, even though the House passed a carbon trading bill. We have a very exciting little video called Story of Cap and Trade, if any of you have seen that, www.storyofstuff.org. You can find the carbon trading bill. But this is what we need to expand to, right? We need this scores and scores of investors like Calvert Group, like Trillium here in Boston, Ben and Jerry's, Global Green Gants, to say, no, we will not take profits from World Bank. That's immoral. Cambridge did it. We need you all to go to Cambridge and say, come on, let's renew this. And major trade unions as well. If not, my friends, you'll be looking like you did during apartheid if you had investments in South Africa. And this time, it's the World Bank, and this planet is now under threat from an institution allied with a corrupt government in South Africa and a terribly ineffective parastatal agency, which shouldn't be getting a cent more. And instead, we're going to have to build up enough power to stop the cheapest electricity in the world going to these big smelters, turn them off, and get that electricity to the masses. That's the program.
Great. Thanks, Professor.
Should we take another round?
Yeah. Arthur?
Yeah. I think you're giving away too much when you say that they're using marginal cost pricing.
there's no rationale for marginal cost pricing in economic theory when you have a declining cost curve. And what you've got is price discrimination and subsidization of monopolies. And it's not justified by even neoliberal or whatever you want to call it, economic theory. And secondly, along those lines, if you've got a big cable going into the mines and you're justifying it that way, why doesn't Soweto incorporate itself, get one big line in, and set up a distribution and claim the same price? And that would destroy it.
It's true. What you're saying, Art, is that this price curve has moved well below the cost curve. It is. It's about 1 cent, whereas the price curve is about five.
I mean, the whole rationale for marginal cost pricing is based on cost curves turning up.
Eventually, and they should,
And they don't for the huge power plants.
Until Madupi, then they turn up really fast.
well, that's it, But no, it's the fixed cost that turns up. It's not the marginal cost.
True, yeah.
And
so interest payments to the World Bank.
Right. So. But anyway, I just think that they're not even right on their own theory. And I like the idea of Soweto having its own line coming in, and then it could be charged, it should... I'd like to know their answer to why it wouldn't be charged the same rate as the mines.
20 years ago, the left in Soweto brought the TVA, Rural Electricity Co-ops model, and brought some of those kind of rural populace in to try to teach the Sowetans how they might do precisely that, set up an electricity buying co-op, when there was a real resistance against the apartheid regime. Unfortunately, the people who were leading that, their names were Cyril Ramaphosa, you might have heard of him, and now they're a major part of the problem. So.
Apropos of that, if I may interject, what do you think about Professor Mumma's sort of opposing the corruption of governments and the corruption of corporations? Under neoliberalism, doesn't that seem a little funny?
Since they're all on the same boat
together. I heard. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that in the South African context or not.
Well, y'all are probably aware that there's a World Cup coming up, right? And that the activists have even said, we're not going to let that happen. Without massive protest. 3 billion people are watching. The government is so terrified that they've now said, well, we're going to call out the army. The resistance is so intense, and this is not an organized, this is spontaneous, disorganized, often chaotic, and sometimes xenophobic resistance. It's like a popcorn protest, they're called. Popcorn, they pop this way, that way. You don't know which ideological direction they're going to land in. But they're so brave, these activists, they're so hatful, they're so fed up, that just 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago, on a Saturday, 3 weeks ago, they actually began a new tactic. Their tactics are usually, in these thousands of protests, to take the roads and block them. They're not environmentally conscious, so they burn tires, and because they get really good flumes of black smoke. I'm sure one of you environmentalists would like to replace the tires with a better device to create the same effect.
Hippies.
You'd be welcome. But the tires burn. The traffic helicopters fly over and report on the morning reports. You know, better avoid the N2 that's coming. You've got to take a 3 or 4 side routes there because there's a service delivery person. We actually learn much more about the social protests from the traffic reports than we do from the regular news. And so these protests, they kind of become nuisance effects. But now they're doing things like burning the councillors' houses, burning libraries, burning municipal buildings. And then 3 weeks ago, they even were so brave that they actually tried to catch one of these tanks. You remember from the old days, the Caspers, they're called. Yeah. They're still called Caspers, and they're huge personnel carriers. And their tires, you know, nearly as high as this room, and they're solid rubber. Somehow these activists, township radicals, caught a Casper in a tank trap using spikes to catch the tires, and then they had a braai. If some of you know what a braai is, it's a barbecue. Luckily, there was nobody in the personnel carrier. They all ran away. But they actually burned a tank in the township called Ochis. So we are looking at an insurrection, an intifada of a formidable anger, although undirected, unstrategized, not ideologically clear. Many of the protests are associated with internecine battles for local power. But this is so serious that I think indeed no honeymoon for Jacob Zuma, by the way, the new president of about a year, was meant to have a sort of a breather from all of these protests, and he was meant to be the popular figure of. But now even the trade unions are saying we can disrupt the World Cup. We can stop if these electricity price increases are coming through. What the World Bank's done then is to, in a sense, give us a solution to a problem we've suffered for a long time: the divisions between
end in green, social justice, environmental. I know you have that problem here. And the USSF, the Detroit meeting's probably going to help put that together. But we had a World Summit on Sustainable Development where it became very clear that our movements had different directions. And I really thank Bill Mumma for justifying this loan simply for helping put this kind of coalition together. Because on February 18, when we had a chance with an expert panel to say, this is outrageous, don't do it, it's so obviously flawed and corrupt and anti-developmental, he said, oh yeah, you can do it, take a few bits of advice, but go ahead and do it. And that then got this huge coalition together, which we think might be the basis then for the kind of challenge to neoliberalism and maybe even to the ruling party's hegemony once finally the trade unions decide that this is just, they're fed up with the lack of change, even though they're candidates in the presidency. They're not getting their national health insurance, or at least fast enough. They're not getting the ban on labor broking. They're even suffering, as of 2 months ago, a new dual labor market where cheaper workers are going to be introduced. The finance minister is giving subsidies for that. And all manner of problems have emerged that reflect not a personality, Thabo Mbeki, that was so hostile to a liberatory agenda. He was denying HIV that caused AIDS. I mean, it's absolutely genocidal, as the technical term, as the Harvard Public Health School has encouraged us to use, counting 330,000 unnecessary deaths. But also, this is a system, and it's a neoliberal system in a peripheral, semi-peripheral economy that has become hollowed out, in which the growth we've had has been in the financial sector and in real estate, much like the United States, and where we're finally putting together the kind of coalitions that you see working against this loan that give me real hope and make me, I hope, suggest that you keep a closer eye on South Africa.
Sure.
I have a piece on this in the next monthly review if y'all are interested. It'll be out in the June issue. So.
Cool. Thanks. If there's anything, any other questions, we can take it. Otherwise, we can just wrap up and have casual conversation. I have a couple hands, one here and one there.
And your name?
Eugene. I graduated from Tufts, where Professor Mumma was. I was going to ask him what he thought about if the mine comes to be and the electricity is mostly used for the mining companies and other sort of big business and it doesn't produce equity, what he would sort of feel about the kind of actions of sort of sabotage by people in communities to, you know, get their basic rights for water, electricity, like is happening. It seems like even in South Africa, there's a little bit of a split amongst progressives or the left or community groups on sort of the tactics and that, like maybe this, the cartoon sort of speaks to that. So I don't know if you have any insight, but I also, sort of two other sort of things that came to mind were, one is sort of the corruption and the idea of the economic hitmen and sort of what effects it all playing into this and these advisors to the World Bank or the corporations themselves in terms of their advice to developing countries implementing big infrastructure projects. And also his sort of last comment on China's, or I couldn't really understand what he was saying, China was asking him to sort of do some progressive ecological environmental estimates for some of their work, but the role of China's investments in Africa, in South Africa and elsewhere in Africa, and how that either is an alternative to the World Bank, or better or worse.
Since there are a lot there, I'll just quickly take them and then we can maybe wrap up with anybody else. But it's basically the last one, China, a debate about precisely can this be a counterweight to U.S. and Western imperial power to have this other source of finance and loans and extractive industries and maybe some new infrastructure to extract more. Or whether this is just inter-imperial rivalry and we're going to be suffering like the grass under two elephants. And those are the questions people are asking. I tend to favor the latter critique because I've seen what the Chinese extractive processes do in places like Zambia. They're terribly destructive and safety and health conditions, super exploitation of labor. But particularly the full gamut in which the import of extremely cheap manufactured goods which have destroyed much of the local manufacturing base and what had been in some cases, Zimbabwe was the third most balanced economy in the world if you take industry as a percentage of GDP, and then it's just been deindustrialized because of these cheap imports. And the imports are cheap because of exploitation and the externalization of costs in China. And then they're pricing out local folks. And it's a terrible thing. It's created a lot of xenophobia, a yellow peril, if you will. And there's even a phrase for Chinese goods, Xinjiang and Hong Kong, that's used quite commonly because they break so quickly. They're so inexpensive. So I think these are really important questions, and we're sort of asking, should we have more inward-oriented growth? Should we have a deglobalization strategy, as Walden Bellow has termed it, to have import substitution and balancing of local industry, has occurred during the last big parallel crisis to this one in the 1930s. That was a period when South Africa grew at its fastest, had its actually fastest black wage to white wage growth, and developed its industry. So yeah, those would be the sort of directions. On what you could ask Bill Mumaw to contribute to this sort of, making a World Bank loan better, obviously there wasn't very much, and it just shows that there are real limits to good, well-intentioned people going in and then deciding for the South African masses that his devil's better than the struggle. To be fair, he was only getting towards the end of that project a lot of the material that we were sending forward. We were sending that material from about the second week of February, and they filed a report the 18th. But this is so obvious, and the critique has come up again and again of ESCOM, and the protests have been so visible that there's just no excuse for what I think is utterly unprofessional work by Professor Bill Mumaw. And I hope at Tufts you'll be able to whip him to shape and demand accountability for researchers who go and make the world a worse place.
Take the last question.
And your name again is?
David Jenkins. I work at East Alternatives for Community and Environment. I hear you saying that getting companies, municipalities, anybody to not invest in World Bank bonds is like a primary strategy. I was chatting with Ashraf Kassim, who you probably know of recently, and we were chatting about what it would look like to do solidarity stuff here around World Bank. And particularly, I had done some work with the Education Rights Project in Salim, and was thinking a lot about sort of World Bank, U.S. academics in education schools like Harvard Graduate School of Education, etc., setting these sort of awesome, awful, just terrible education policies that were then deployed throughout the Global South, and consulting projects on, etc. We were thinking about, this idea of, what would it look like as solidarity actions, direct actions, that were actually targeting the cushy little academics who are reaping in huge consulting contracts, consulting either just, in this case, legitimizing, or in some cases, promoting some really horrific policies. And so I wanted to put out there, and being someone who works in a community organization but does some links and does some work with student and campus activists, I wonder what you think about the sort of possibility of direct action around, particularly I'm talking about disrupting the daily life of the academics in U.S. universities who are supporting, promoting, legitimizing the sort of World Bank policy, putting it out there, et cetera, and what that potential sort of strategy, whether that would have impact or whether that would just be something, whether it would just be fun or whether it would be
Well, I'll end by saying I've got a professional interest in an affirmative answer to your question, but I'm going to turn it on its head. How you handle your existing ruling class and its apologists is going to be up to you, and all power to you. But there's an interesting epistemological problematic. I mean, how is knowledge produced? Do you produce knowledge in your armchair at Tufts? And you go and be a consultant for the World Bank, maybe you get into the field a bit. Or do you go into a battle with the World Bank and with ESCOM and with your governments? And if you do the latter, which is the epistemology at our university, Center for Civil Society, University of KwaZulu-Natal, can you make a claim to having a stronger evidence-based analysis of how an oppressive system like South African energy and the climate and the electricity disconnections, how that works? I was glad that Bill Mumaw began by saying, Patrick knows a lot more about this than me. The reason I know is because the activists have come again and again with their problems. And they've said, what the hell's going on? And why is now the World Bank party to this? And it's in asking the tough questions, and it's seeing the reactions to protests, It's beginning to test whether the U.S. will abstain or maybe even vote no, and what other forces around the world are lined up, that we can really begin to see whether a capitalist system and an imperialist institution like the World Bank gives you space to do something as magnanimous as increase your electricity supply and deal with the climate, as good Professor Mumma would suggest. It's pretty evident that it doesn't give you that space, and that there's really, in a world that's constrained by climate and poverty, no room anymore for a major institution that makes both those problems much, much worse. So, my friends, that's the only marching orders I can really give you. Fight for the epistemological right to produce knowledge in conflict instead of from an armchair getting a consultancy. And close the fucking World Bank. Please, take your money out. Thanks, friends.
Thanks, Professor Bonds. I can only hope that you have a distance PhD program at your center, because I'm never going to get a fucking degree here, man. I'll tell you. So, anyway, thanks for coming, folks, and please come to future Encuentro Cinco events.